ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Labor's attempt to rush extraordinary immigration powers through Parliament was rejected by the Senate last week. The Coalition, Greens and Crossbench MPs were given just over 24 hours to examine the legislation when it was introduced, and they joined forces and blocked the bill. The government, it's fair to say, had few friends in the Senate. Now, a Senate inquiry will examine the controversial legislation that could put asylum seekers in jail for refusing to be deported and blacklist entire country citizens from obtaining visas to Australia. And that report's due by May the 7th. Later this month, the High Court will begin hearing a case of an Iranian man who's refusing to cooperate with authorities to be sent back to Iran, where he says he fears persecution. Well, joining us again for the Nightlife News Breakdown is Mark Kenny, Canberra Times political analyst and professor at the ANU's Australian Studies Institute. He also hosts the Democracy Sausage podcast. Mark, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thanks, Philip. Good to be here.
Now, what's behind the government's strategy here? What's at stake?
Well, I suppose what's at stake here, really, the way the government sees it, is its reputation as either being in charge of the immigration system and of borders, or having lost control of it in the way that proved politically toxic for previous iterations of Labor when in power. So that's the charge that Peter Dutton and Scott Morrison and others have been leading for years, that Labor is weak on borders, that it made mistakes when it was around last time, and that invited people smugglers back into operation. We saw, you know, boats being wrecked off the coast of Christmas Island and other sorts of things. And all this is part of a, you know, part and parcel of a problem that Labor says it wants to do what the coalition does, but it doesn't quite believe in it. And I've even seen this repeated by a number of, let's say, coalition-friendly columnists in recent days. So the government here is trying to look tough. It was obviously caught off guard by that extraordinary High Court decision late last year, which said that it could, the state couldn't indefinitely detain people if there was no hope of their repatriation, of them being found somewhere else to live. And we have, so we had that patched up, but we now have a situation where we've got people, we're told, who are refusing to cooperate with their deportation, refusing to provide even basic details. And so the government's taken advice on this. This is a separate group, I suppose, from what you might say are people who have you know, been found guilty of crimes and served a custodial sentence and now are being deported. These are people who are claiming refugee status, claiming asylum, but have been through all of the processes that we have. I guess we have to have We take on trust here that our processes are thorough and robust. But anyway, they've been through all those processes, and at the end of it, they've been found to not have a valid case, and we need to deport them, and we need their cooperation in doing so. And what the government's looking to do here now, bearing in mind this case that you just mentioned that's coming up, it's looking to make it a criminal offence not to cooperate with Australian authorities.
So that means they wouldn't have to detain you. They could then put you in jail.
Precisely. You would now have a custodial sentence rather than indefinite detention. You'd be in the criminal system for failing to cooperate with authorities. I guess, you know, it raises a whole range of questions, one of which is, as I said, you know, whether we have absolute confidence in our processes. And this case that's coming up, I think it's called ASF 17. It's an Iranian. I think the applicant is either homosexual or bisexual. Either way, not a very popular sexuality to have in Iran, and believes that they would, he or she would be in mortal danger if forced to return. Our authorities have decided they don't believe that or don't care, and as a result of that, the matter's going to court.
Yes, I think the government's basically saying they don't believe that is that case. That's correct.
If what happens though if a person does cooperate with deportation, but the country won't accept them?
That's a good question. I think, like in Iran's case, my understanding is that Iran's policy is that it won't take people who aren't cooperating. You know, this is one of those things. So if someone is prepared to go back, then they're allowed to go back, as I understand it. This might be wrong, but my understanding is if they want to go back, then Iran's prepared to take them, and that may be the position of some other countries, but they won't take people who have fled their country, sought asylum somewhere else, and who are refusing or trying not to be sent back there. Iran, as I understand it, in those circumstances won't cooperate with Australian authorities and take someone against their will. Perhaps it's one of the only areas where they actually care about someone's will, but there it is.
Yes, I mean, the ethics of this, of course, have been debated uphill and down dale. The Greens think that the ethics are questionable. This is the Greens immigration spokesperson, Senator David Shoebridge, asking when asked if he thinks the legislation is cruel.
I don't know how else you can describe legislation other than cruel. When, for example, we have a man at the moment who says that if he's returned to Iran, that he will almost certainly be persecuted because of his sexuality. I mean, that seems to me to be a pretty fundamental and obvious statement. If a man has identified as bisexual, he's very, very likely to face significant persecution if he's returned to Iran. But this government wants the power to put him in jail for a minimum 1 year, up to 5 years, if he doesn't sign paperwork agreeing to a passport and his return to Iran.
Yes, I mean, there have been a number of multicultural leaders across Australia who've expressed shock at these immigration proposals too. I understand that another leg of the proposal is that if a country won't accept them back, then the Australian government will accept no visa applicants from that country to come to Australia.
That's the other leg of this. Just before we go to that, I mean, I think the point Senator Shoebridge is making there is a prima facie, a pretty valid one. That if we know that it's illegal or that they simply deny the existence of different sexualities in Iran and that people are persecuted materially to the point of, in some cases, being killed, then a person may have what we would call in immigration circles a well-founded fear of persecution upon their return. But obviously this has been through a series of courts and tribunals and appeals and all of those processes, and the government wants to continue. So we have this bizarre situation where the opposition passed the bill in the lower house and then opposed it along with the Greens.
What are they doing here? They're just playing politics here, aren't they? Are they or not? I mean, because they're not going to block it in the end, are they? Because
I don't think they're going to block it, but I'd stop short of saying they're just playing politics. There's no doubt they're enjoying the government's pain over this, because clearly the government has, you know, rushed this legislation through. It basically was provided to the opposition on Tuesday morning. They wanted it voted on that day. They wanted it through the Senate the next day. And at no point has there been any proper argument put forward as to why this is suddenly so urgent. In fact, the government says it's not primarily involved or turning on the ASF 17 case, that it's a loophole that's been existent for years and that they've discovered and been advised should be closed, and they're looking to do that. But they've not provided any sufficient evidence of why it needs to be rushed so precipitately through the chambers. And so I think the opposition and the other parties in the Senate are quite within their rights, and indeed I think doing the procedurally sound thing of saying, well, you haven't given us a good case for urgency, and so we're not going to treat it urgently. We're going to have a proper review, a proper Senate inquiry. We're going to go through it clause by clause, take evidence from experts in this area, and make sure that when this law is passed by the Parliament, if that is the outcome, that it has been properly considered in all those ways. And so, but yeah, it's you know, the government's trying to get it done. The opposition doesn't particularly want to get it done, but will in the end vote for it. I think you're right there.
Yeah. Look, speaking of immigration, number of migrants are still rising, as are house prices. Heaven knows what can be done about this, but economists are predicting property prices to keep climbing as demand continues to outstrip supply. New data from PropTrack shows house prices have grown for both the combined capital cities and regions. Sydney's median property value is now $1.70 million, up 8% on a year ago. Perth, Adelaide and Brisbane have all seen double-digit growth. This is AMP's chief economist Shane Oliver on the housing market.
It's been swamped, overwhelmed, if you like, by an undersupply of property as immigrants returned, particularly students, that used up spare housing in Australia. So rents went through the roof. It pushed up house prices in the way, offsetting the negative impact of higher interest rates.
It's almost counterintuitive, isn't it, Mark? I mean, cost of living crisis, people have got no... But there's a two-stream economy out in the property market, aren't there? People have got property and people who don't.
Yes, and many of the people who've got property have got more than one property. You know, they've got a number of them in some cases, and they're getting very, very generous tax breaks to hold on to those properties and to expand their property portfolio in that way as well. So, you know, that's part of the problem. We have policy settings that encourage people to do this. Taxpayers, even people who aren't in the property market themselves, they can't afford to be, are nonetheless subsidising these investments. So that's one of the problems. As you say, the other is that we have, you know, a supply and demand problem, and we have a two-track economy in the sense that we have a lot of people with enough money to do these things, and we have a lot of other people, a big lot of other people, who are really struggling to make ends meet. And that's what the settings of monetary and fiscal policy have been about for the last 12 months or so, you know, squeezing people deliberately to clamp down on demand. Well, it seems to have worked in a range of areas, but not the housing market, where it's been going gangbusters.
Exactly. What can they get? I mean, the government could cut migration. They could, couldn't they?
Well, it could. I mean, it needs to be very careful how it does that. I think the advice that I've seen is that immigration numbers will start to come down relatively quickly now. A lot of this has been driven, as Shane Oliver said, they're driven by students coming back into the country in significant numbers, soaking up a lot of housing, but also, you know, being represented in those migration numbers. But it doesn't mean that that isn't politically quite significant. I mean, economically, it's been it's one of the reasons why we haven't been in recession. I mean, we, as a number of people have noted, we've probably been in per capita recession in a number of quarters, or at least one, two quarters. Because we've been, you know, have an expanding population, this has been driving our growth. That's pretty much been the Australian story for a long time. You know, we're a multicultural, immigration-driven country. We have been for a long time. So it's a question of how you get the balance right on all of these things. And the government's saying that, you know, migration intake will come down, and will come down quite measurably fairly soon as these things even out. But there's no doubt there's some political heat in it, and there's a bit of dog whistling going on about, you know, that explains why it's difficult to get a house and why the roads are clogged and all these sort of things. Which is drawing a long bow, but there it is.
Yep. Speaking of political strategies, the opposition's decided to talk tough on reining in the big supermarket giants, Coleswurst's. They're saying they'll have a big stick approach. Opposition leader Peter Dutton and Nationals leader David Littleproud are keen to put the cost of living front and centre heading into a federal election. Fair enough, I would think. But are they actually really going to, in the end, do much? Or can they do much, do you think, Mark?
It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because in a sense this charts the change in the Liberal Party in the coalition, but particularly the Liberal Party, the senior part of the coalition, over a number of years, and really accelerated under Peter Dutton. He has explicitly sort of separated himself from the Liberal Party of big business, you know, the party of free enterprise, of big investment, of, you know, the party that had a very strong relationship with big business. He's come in, he said the Liberal Party is the party of the working class. And, you know, you'll notice that he's not been doing much signalling at all in terms of trying to get back those Teal seats. He's been all about communicating with the people in the suburbs, the outer suburbs and the regions of Australia on the sort of retail questions. So we're getting a lot of anti-woke stuff, which is part, you know, tied up in this as well. It doesn't like big businesses being involved in social issues or environmental issues. You know, they're sort of frightening people about their utes being taken off them. They're talking the language of people who are really doing it tough, as we've just been discussing, when they go to the supermarket. And this argument that consumers are being gouged by this duopoly, it's a pretty powerful argument. Most people have first-hand experience of it being true to an extent as well, I guess. So that's really what I think is the politics here. It's all part of the change in where the Liberal Party is now, how it sees itself and how it's trying to present itself. But I think the other thing that's quite fascinating about it, Philip, is that it shows yet again how much, how different it is having a Queensland LNP MP as the leader of the coalition, and how much more power it seems the Nationals have within that coalition. Because if we think about three big things that we've been talking about recently, obviously the Voice last year, the referendum, well, it was the year before in November of 2022 when David Littleproud and Nampajimpa Price decided to declare their position against the Voice, against a yes vote in the Voice referendum. And really from that moment on, Dutton was kind of locked in to that position. It would have been very difficult for him to take a different position from the Nats, particularly in Queensland where they're all supposedly one party, the LNP. We've seen the Nats driving this new policy, which is also yet to come out, about nuclear energy. Again, a pretty remarkable pivot, but one where Dutton feels like he can sort of use it to say, don't worry about all this renewable stuff, we can make this transition by going nuclear. And now we have this idea, and it really is quite a marked departure, as I say, the Liberal Party now saying, we're going to bust up this duopoly, we're going to make it harder, we want divestiture powers so that these major companies can no longer do the sorts of things they're doing. In other words, they can no longer act in ways that are maximising the benefit for their shareholders and their bottom line. We're going to take this action. I mean, you could, if you close your eyes and squint or whatever it is, that's probably doing two things that don't make sense. But if you think about it in historical ways, it's the kind of thing you might have expected a Labor Party to be talking about a few decades ago, and now we have the Liberal Party talking about it.
Yep, indeed. Mark, always great to talk. Thank you.
Good on you, Philip. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.